Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Natalie Diaz. Natalie Diaz grew up in the Fort Mojave Indian Village in Needles, California, on the banks of the Colorado River. She is Mojave and an enrolled member of the Gila River Indian community. After playing professional basketball in Europe and Asia for several years, she completed an MFA in poetry and fiction from Old Dominion University in 2007. She currently lives in Mojave Valley, Arizona, and directs a language revitalization program at Fort Mojave, her home reservation. There she works with the last elder speakers of the Mojave language. Natalie's first book, When My Brother Was an Aztec, has had a great success with Copper Canyon Press. And I'll just mention a couple of the awards she's won. She's won a U.S. Artist Ford Fellowship, a Lannan Foundation Fellowship. Currently is transplanted in Princeton, New Jersey, as a recipient of the 2015 Hodder Fellowship. And she teaches also at the Institute of American Indian Art. Hi, Natalie. How are you doing?
I'm doing well.
It's so great to have you here in Pittsburgh, and it's really exciting. So I'm going to ask you to just read some poems.
Okay. Cloud Watching. Betsy Ross needled hot stars to Mr. Washington's bedspread. They weren't hers to give. So when the cavalry came, we ate their horses. Then, unfortunately, our bellies were filled with bullets. Pack the suitcases with white cans of corned beef. When we leave, our hunger will go with us, following behind a dog with ribs like a harp. Blue gourds glow and rattle like a two-man band, Hotchkiss on backup vocals and Gatling on drums. The rhythm is set by our boys dancing the warpath, the meth three-step. Grandmothers dance their legs off. Who now will teach us to stand? We carry dimming lamps like God cages. They help us to see that it is dark. In the dark, our hands pretend to pray, but really make love. Soon we'll give birth to fists. They'll open up black eyes and split grins. We'll all cry out. History has chapped lips, unkissable lips. He gave me a coral necklace that shines bright as a chokehold. He gives and gives. Census names given to Mojaves, George and Martha Washington, Abraham Lincoln, Robin Hood, Rip Van Winkle. Loot bag ghosts float fatly in dark museum corners. I see my grandfather's flutes and rabbit sticks in their guts. About the beautiful dresses emptied of breasts. They were nothing compared to the emptied bodies. Splintering cradleboards sing bone lullabies. They hush the mention of half-breed babies buried or left on riverbanks. When you ask about officers who chased our screaming women into the arrowweeds, they only hum. A tongue will wrestle its mouth to death and lose. Language is a cemetery. Tribal dentists light lab coat pyres in memoriam of lost molars. Our cavities are larger than HUD houses. Some Indians' wisdom teeth never stop growing back in. We were made to bite back until we learn to bite first. And something interesting about that poem is there's a line that mentions the census names given to Mojaves. And these were real names that were given, you know, in order to assimilate them into English. So they took away their native names. And I was really struck when I realized that there was a Mojave man named Abraham Lincoln and a Mojave man named Robin Hood and Rip Van Winkle, and that it must have been this great joke when these names were given to these people who were destitute and starving. That's something that really struck me, and that's kind of where this poem, you know, burst from. I was thinking about some of those historical moments of pride in our history. I have a little brother who was in the military. He was in Afghanistan for several years, and so this is a poem that's actually his story, and he told it to me, and so it became then my story, and I felt like I had a responsibility to it. It starts with an epigraph from Wisława Szymborska, forgive me distant wars for bringing flowers home. Why don't mention flowers when conversations with my brother reach uncomfortable silences? In the Kashmir Mountains, my brother shot many men, blue skulls from brown skins, dyed white desert sand crimson. What is there to say to a man who has traversed such a world, whose hands and eyes have betrayed him? Were there flowers there? I asked. This is what he told me. In a village, many men wrapped a woman in a sheet. She didn't struggle. Her bare feet dragged in the dirt. They laid her in the road and stoned her. The first man was her father. He threw two stones in a row. Her brother had filled his pockets with stones on the way there. The crowd was a hive of disturbed bees. The volley of stones against her body drowned out her moans. Blood burst through the sheet like a patch of violets, 100 roses in bloom. And again, this was a poem that it did come from the uncomfortable silences mentioned in the title, and to imagine that, you know, to imagine the terrible things the silence held, and then to think that I was able to put this terrible thing down on the page, and to know that I still haven't come close to how awful it really was, and to know that you know, the real magnitude of it exists in that silence and how difficult it was to talk with him when he came home. The beauty of a busted fruit. When we were children, we traced our knees, shins, and elbows for the slightest hint of wound, searched them for any sad red-blue scab marking us both victim and survivor. All this before we knew that some wounds can't heal, before we knew the jagged scars of great-grandmother's amputated legs, the way a rock can split a man's head open to its red syrup, like a watermelon, the way a brother can pick at his skin for snakes and spiders only he can see. Maybe you have grown out of yours. Maybe you no longer haul those wounds with you onto every bus through the side streets of a new town. Maybe you have never set them rocking in the lamplight on a nightstand beside a stranger's bed, carrying your hurts like two cracked pomegranates, because you haven't learned to see the beauty of a busted fruit, the bright stain it will leave on your lips, the way it will make people want to kiss you.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Natalie Diaz. She's reading from her book, When My Brother Was an Aztec. Those are some heavy poems that you're reading, and wonderful poems, but, you know, I'm wondering about the relationship between violence and language in your work, and if you feel compelled as a writer to record some of those stories, or if you think even that that's one of the reasons you became a writer.
Yeah, and I think especially lately the notion or the idea that violence and tenderness exist in the same place and often in the same words and even in the same gestures, to know that my hands are capable of very tender things, but also most of the violences that I've taken part in have also happened with my hands or began at my hands. And so I think for me, something that's been important as I've learned more about what poetry means to me and what I can do with poetry, it is the notion that writing these poems, even about difficult moments or about violent moments within my family or within my community, there are also opportunities for me to express my love for those people and those places. If they didn't matter to me, I wouldn't sit down and force myself to look at them and to let myself be uncomfortable. And sometimes I think that I can love the people, in particular my brother, best on the page in a way that in real life it's difficult to love him and to hold him as close as I'm able to hold him on the page. And sometimes that is to be able to describe his body or to describe the way that he's wrecked himself or that he's been wrecked.
Yeah. Well, I know that very attached to image in your work, and that often that you talk, I've heard you talk before about exploding the image and exploding images.
You like to break things.
Yeah. Could you talk a little bit about that in your work, how image works for you, and what is your attachment? I mean, obviously, poets are attached to image, but not like you. I mean, you have a special relationship to it, I think.
Yeah, well, I think for me, I think it's hard to hold my emotions. I think it's hard to get close to my emotions. But I think the way I view image on the page is as a kind of container for my emotions. I'm not writing about my real brother. I'm not writing about my real brother named Richie, who I grew up with. And I'm writing about these images of my brother, or I'm writing about this Aztec that I'm able to build with images, and these images are where I can place my emotions. And so I think that idea, the way the image works as this container for these great emotions that I can't get close to, that's been a real power for me in terms of being able to look at some of these stories and some of the places I've been. The painter Francis Bacon says that when he painted, and he made a great distinction between illustrations and painting. If he was going to illustrate something, it was basically the shell of the image, you know, like, okay, this is kind of what this looks like. But to paint something for him was to render it emotionally. And he said that his idea of an image was to return it to the nervous system more violently. So, and I think sometimes we hear violently and we freak out a little bit, but what he meant was he wanted to build the image in a way that made you feel again, that made the audience feel something again. And for me, the image is the risk that I can take, my emotional risk. Like, I can risk being vulnerable through the image. It gives me a little bit of padding, I think. And in that padding is freedom. I don't have to worry about being, you know, quote, sentimental, or I don't have to worry about being trite or being, you know, overly emotional or a sad sob story. I can show you the pain or the joy or all of these things through image. And again, language feels really lucky to me in that way, to look at it as this kind of thing that you can build. You can build a new container for your life and all your life experiences in poetry.
Yeah, great answer. Okay, could you read some more?
Toward the amaranth gates of war or love. Tonight the city is glimmered. What's left of an August monsoon is heat and wet. Beyond the open window, the street lamp is a honey-skirted hive I could split with my hand, my palm a pool of light. On the television screen, bombs like silvery bells toll above blurred horizon. All I know of war is win. What is a wall if not a thing to be pressed against? What is a bedroom if not an epicenter of pillage? And what can I do with 100 houses but abandon them as spent shells of desire? The buzz of blue-burning ozone molecules, a hypothalamus of cavalry trumpets, call me to something, you, so willing to be crushed. I feel like I might die. I lean over, kiss you sitting on the sofa, and pretend we are lying there, stretched across that debris-dazzled desert. The only affliction is your mouth. The single ache is that I cannot crawl inside you. The explosions are for us. The war is nothing more than a reminder to go to mass. The tolling, your sighing. The bombs, a carnival of bodies, touch all the things we want to taste. An apple wedge soaked in vinegar. A blood orange swelling like a breast. Those beggars of teeth. I want you like that, enough to gnash you into a silence made from pieces of silver. Outside, cars rush the slick streets. My mouth is on your thigh. I would die to tear just this piece of you away, to empty your bright dress onto the floor, as the bomb's long, shadowy legs march me toward the amaranth gates of the city. Soirée fantastique. Houdini arrived first with Antigone on his arm. Someone should have told her it was rude to chase my brother in circles with such a shiny shovel. She only said, "I'm building the man a funeral." But the last I measured, my brother was still a boy. The doorbell chimes and chimes. Other guests come in and out, snorting, mouths lathered, eyes spinning like spirogyros. They are starving, bobbing their big heads, ready for a party. They keep saying it, too. "Man, we're ready for a party." In their glorious twirl and dervish, none of them notices this is no dinner party. This is a jalopy carousel, and we are dizzy. We are here to eat the horses. There are violins playing. The violins are on fire. They're all passed around until we're smoking. Jesus coughs, climbs down from the cross of railroad ties above the table. He's a regular at these carry-on revelries, and it's annoying how he turns the bread to fish, especially when we have sandwiches. I've never had the guts to ask Jesus why. Old Houdini can't get over him, the hole in each of Jesus's hands. He's smitten and drops first a butter knife, then a candelabra through the gaping in the right hand. He holds Jesus' left palm up to his face, wriggles his tongue through the opening, then spits, says, "This tastes like love." He laughs hysterically. "Admit it, Chewie. Between you and me, someone else is coming." Antigone is back, this time with the green-handled garden spade. "Where is your brother?" she demands. She doesn't realize this is not my brother's feast. He simply set the table. Poor Antigone. "Bury the horses instead," I tell her. "What will we eat then?" she weeps, not knowing weeping isn't what it used to be. Not here. Poor, poor Antigone. I look around for Houdini to get her out of here. He's escaped. In the corner, Jesus covers his face with his hands, each hole an oubliette. I see right through them. None of us belong here. I'm the only one left to say it. I ease the spade from her hand. I explain. We aren't here to eat. We are being eaten. Come, pretty girl, let us devour our lives.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Natalie Diaz, reading from her book, When My Brother Was an Aztec. Natalie, I want to ask you about diction and language. And I've heard you say that when you're writing a poem that you don't want to, and you're using dialogue, that you don't want to put down anything an Indian wouldn't say or the way an Indian wouldn't say it. And can you talk about that? I mean, can you talk about what's involved in that for you? I mean, well, that's a big question, but, you know, obviously you're involved in the language revitalization project at the Mojave Reservation, but it seems like all the work you're doing is language, 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 and did you always feel that whatever you would write dialogue-wise would be something an Indian would say?
I think I've come to that. I feel lucky that I grew up in a place where you talk straight, and by that, you know, it doesn't mean you can't joke and that you can't kid or you can't curse, but you try your best to say what you mean or to mean the things that you say. And I think that's something that's really a really lucky perspective to have, and especially working with my native language, where I realize what's lost when you lose a single word, or what recovering a single word can gift you with. And so I think what I mean predominantly when I say, like, I want to talk the way I talk on the page. The words that I use on the page are meaningful to me. So it doesn't mean that I can't find a word in, like, the OED, for example. It just means that before I let myself use a word, whether it's to rebuild or re-envision or repaint a moment or something, someone from my home or my reservation would say, I have to find a way to make it meaningful to me again. And so if I'm going to use a word like love, for example, or to use a word like belly instead of stomach, like I have to find a way to make those words feel new to me again. And to me, that feels like it means I have to kind of break the shell that they've been delivered to me in and make them a little bit messy maybe and painful again so that I feel connected to them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We have time for some more poems, if you could read some more.
Sure. I'm going to read 63 haiku poems. No. It's a crown of haiku. This is a poem I wrote after reading a couple poems about Lot's wife, the Szymborska and the Akhmatova poems. And I think at that point in time, I thought you had to have a poem about Lot's wife in order to be a poet. And so
I guess I'm not a poet.
I tried to build this one. I know, but then once I picked up your book, I realized it was too late. I'd already done this one. I'd already committed this error. Of course she looked back. You would have too. From that distance, the shivering city fit in the palm of her hand like she owned it. She could have blown the whole thing, markets, dance halls, hookah bars, sent the city and its 100 harems tumbling across the desert like a kiss. She had to look back. When she did, she saw pigeons glinting like debris above ruined rooftops, towers swaying, women in broken skirts strewn along burnt-out streets like busted red bells. The noise was something else. Dogs wept, roosters howled, children and guitars popped like kernels of corn feeding the twisting blaze. She wondered, had she unplugged the coffee pot, the iron? Was the oven off? Her husband uttered, keep going, whispered, stay the course, or baby, forget about it. She couldn't. Now a bursting garden of fire, the city bloomed to flame after flame, like hot fruit in a persimmon orchard. Someone thirsty asked for water. Someone scared asked to pray. Her daughters, or the crooked-legged angel, maybe. Dark thighs of smoke open to the sky. She meant to look away, but the sting in her eyes, the taste devouring her tongue, and the neighbors begging her name.
Well, that's not your average Lot's wife poem. Yeah, that's
well, and that line came from the stay the course, you know, and so there's a lot of war in this book, I realized. And so I tried to imagine what recourse a woman had in the face of war. And, women weren't the ones making these decisions, and yet somehow we're always stuck there cleaning up the mess, you know, trying to turn the oven off, trying to ease everybody in the midst of these wars that are started. And so, yeah, and so that's kind of where I ended up. So, Lot's wife. So this is it's a type of love poem. And I was trying to imagine it from an addict's perspective. And, I thought, my brother does all of these things, but he also loves, you know, he also wants and desires. And so I let myself try to move toward his perspective and things he's seen. I lean out the window and she nods off in bed, the needle gently rocking on the bedside table. While she sleeps, I paint Valencia oranges across her skin, 7 times the color orange, a bright tree glittering the limestone grotto of her clavicle. heaving bonfires pulsing each pale limb like Nero's condemned heretics sparking along Via Appia. A small stream of Prussian blue I've trickled down her bicep. A fat red nasturtium eddies her inner elbow. Against her swollen palms I've brushed glowing halves of avocados, lamping like bell-hipped women in ecstasy. A wounded Saint Teresa sketched to each breast. Her navel is a charcoal bowl of figs, all stem thick with sour milk and gowned in taffeta the color of bruises. This to offer up with our flophouse prayers. God created us with absence in our hands, but we will not return that way. Not now, when we are both so capable of growing full on banquets embroidered by Lorca's gypsy nun. She sleeps, gone to the needle's gentle rocking, and I lean out the window, a Horace drunk on my own scent and midnight's slow drip of stars. She has always been more orchard than loved, I more bite than mouth. So much is empty in this hour, the spoon still warm lost in the sheets, the candle's yellow-white thorn of flame, a vanishing ribbon of jade smoke, and night, open as autumn's unfilled basket, as the locusts feast the field.
We have time for one more short one, if you have something like that.
Prayers or oubliettes. Despair has a loose daughter. I lay with her and read the body's bones like stories. I can tell you the year-long myth of her hips, how I numbered stars, the abacus of her mouth. The sheets are berserk with winds riddling. All the beds of the past cannot dress the ghosts at my table. Their breasts rest on plates like broken goblets whose rims I once thirsted at. Instead of grace, we rattle forks in our empty bowls. We are the musings of the desert, crying out like mockers from memory's violet towers. We scour the earth as Isis did. Fall is forever here. Women's dresses wrinkle on the ground. Men fall to their knees in heaps, genitals rotting like spent fruit. Even our roots fall from the soil. The world has tired of tears. We weep owls now. They live longer. They know their way in the dark. Unfasten your cage of teeth and tongue. The taste of a thousand moths is chalk. The mottled wings are the words to pain. We have no Mazel Tov. We call out for our mothers with empty wine jugs at our heels.
It's the poetry of Natalie Diaz. Thank you so much. That was wonderful.
Thank you, Jan.
You've been listening to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Saturday morning at 6:30 for Prosody. 90.5 WESA.